Death. A topic of discussion that is taboo, talked of in hushed tones if talked of at all. But with an aging population and a rise in the number of chronic diseases and comorbidity, is it time the medical community reconsiders its approach to the discussion of death? Hello, I'm Zane Colling and welcome to the third episode of MJA Podcasts. In this episode, Professor Michael Ashby, Director of Palliative Care at the Royal Hobart Hospital, Skypes in with Kate Swanell from his offices to discuss the need for more open debate about death and dying and the way doctors can facilitate a good death. The conversation also canvasses the public health response to the discussion of death and the future of palliative care, including the controversial topic of euthanasia.
This is Kate Swanell for the Medical Journal of Australia and welcome to the latest in our centenary series of podcasts. Today, our special guest is Professor Michael Ashby, Director of Palliative Care at Royal Hobart Hospital and Southern Tasmania Area Health Service. Welcome to the show, Professor Ashby.
Hello, thank you.
There's no question we're all getting, the population's getting older. Is it true that we're also, apart from living longer, it's taking us longer to die?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's become clear is that if you went back a generation or two, most people would kind of die of one thing. They'd either die suddenly from a heart attack or a stroke or an accident or some very rapid single pathology disease. Now what tends to happen is that we're all living longer, but we're acquiring more chronic diseases.
Right.
And then at the end of longer lives, which is the kind of upside, the downside is that we then have a tendency to have to put up with a 1 to 2 years of increasing burden of disease, more sickness, more what we call morbidity, more disability, more interference with our capacity to live normal lives. And we're just sicker, more dependent, more likely to go to hospital. And the trouble is that we often don't know where we are on those journeys until the final terminal phase arrives, and we're often poorly equipped to deal with that as well.
You developed a health promotion project in Tasmania called Healthy Dying.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that and how it might benefit patients who are nearing the end of their life?
Look, the idea of the Healthy Dying initiative was to make our society and healthcare system more, if you like, death friendly. That really the underpinning principle was work that my colleague Alan Kelleher, a sociologist, did in Melbourne in the 90s before he went off to the UK and Canada. What he basically said was, if you want to change the way we deal with death and dying as a society, we have to do it in the same way that we get people to wear seatbelts, the way we get people to stop smoking, the way we get people to have safe sex. All these messages, of course, are about living longer. This one's a little bit counterintuitive because it's about acknowledging finitude, acknowledging the ends of our lives.
Yeah.
And so what he said was the way we did that was we did multimodal public health interventions. So we'd be on the television, we'd be in schools, we'd be talking to seniors clubs, to service clubs, anywhere that would listen, we'd put the message out there that we were trying to get across.
Is it true that actually when you start talking to people about this, they want to talk about this? Because there seems to be a perception that we don't want to talk about death at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose that, you know, if you go home today and you go out with a group of friends and they say, well, what have you been up to? So, well, I've been thinking about death. They'd probably think you were depressed and they'd think it was odd. Although there is actually a movement in the States and in the UK called death in the cafe or death in the pub, where people are having these discussions rather like philosophy in the pub.
Yeah.
Where they're trying to get people to engage about serious issues in more relaxed everyday environments.
Yeah.
Certainly, once you get over the initial blockages that we all naturally tend to have about talking about these matters, then yes, people will often, if you'll forgive the pun, come alive. They'll be very keen to engage.
Yeah. We're looking at, in our centenary year, we're looking forward in the sense that we're trying to figure out what are the next big issues in various specialties and areas of medicine. Where is pain management and palliative care going, and what are the big issues that, will come to the fore in the next 5 to 10 years, say?
Well, look, in cancer pain and palliative care pain management, as opposed to persistent chronic pain in the broader community, I think the thing that we've learned is that there's more to pain relief than just opioids and just drugs, that you really do have to deal with the whole person. But also we have to recognise that that pain is a very complex biological phenomenon, and that inflammation, for instance, is a very big part of it, and our capacity to block a lot of those pathways is still, there's still a lot of work to be done. So I think better anti-inflammatory drugs, probably less reliance on the morphine family of drugs as the single therapy for severe pain. I think that's changing. And hopefully new molecules, new drugs, new approaches to the management of inflammatory and cancer pain. Those would be the big headlines. And I think there'll continue to be progress there. That's hopefully almost inevitable.
What about palliative care and for example, euthanasia? Where do you think that's going? I know you were a supporter of recently of some legislation that didn't get through Tasmania.
Yes.
Where do you see all of those issues going nationally? Obviously, Belgium's had a big breakthrough in the last couple of months. Canada have just knocked back another round of legislation about euthanasia. Is it inevitable? And where are we going and how fast are we going there?
I think it is inevitable that eventually another Australian jurisdiction will vote in favour. Mm. If you look at the trends here in Tasmania, which is essentially like a number of the states and territories in Australia, quite conservative, but also with a kind of radical libertarian streak. I think the gap is closing. I think there's a generational shift here. And whilst I don't think that euthanasia is going to solve all the problems that its proponents believe it will, there's no doubt that our community has a very, very strong view that when, in certain circumstances where life has become just too difficult with pain, suffering, loss of role, loss of identity, loss of independence, most of all, I think, then there's a very widespread view in our community that there's a point at which people want to have the capacity to have assistance to die.
Yeah.
And I think that is an unstoppable force, and I think that it's only a matter of time before it comes in one of our parliaments and is successful. Again, as it was briefly in the territory, of course.
And the ACT for a very brief time, wasn't it? Yes.
No, not in the ACT. Only in the Northern Territory was it actually possible to have assistance to die until it was overturned by the federal legislation.
Right. I was doing a little research earlier this morning. I was looking at Canada had some legislation going through, and then because the political party in charge decided they needed to have an election, the legislation got just stomped on. And I was looking at some of the comments and reaction to that legislation getting through, and it reminded me of the almost like the anti-vaccination lobby in their zealous, you know, the absolute intransigency of their view that.
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously in Canada they have a conservative government at the moment, which, rather like our coalition governments, has to accommodate what I call the religious right. That's a reality of political alignment. And I think, you know, we probably also need to accept that about one in five of our population, with the present polls, about 80% in favour, about one in five of our population feel very strongly that the one thing you cannot do under any circumstances, cut the thread of life, that is a matter for divine intervention only. And I think it's important for us to respect that and understand that, but that people who hold those religious views should then, when in the minority, feel that they are entitled then to dominate public policy and the law, that is, of course, a problem. I think we have to accept that our community will be forever divided on this. I don't think it's ever going to be 100% in favour. And I don't think that one should think that it will solve all the problems. Because if you look at the data from Belgium and Holland, it's under 2% of the population, or 2% of deaths, that are actually activating the legislation. But I think a lot of Australians feel very, very strongly about the libertarian issues, that just knowing that the freedom is there if you need to avail yourself of it is important to a lot of our citizens. And I think that's also the case too in the medical profession and in our parliaments. I think there are a lot of people there who are probably being very cautious because, you know, they do feel a huge responsibility with these matters. And they've historically been more cautious on life and death issues, such as, for instance, capital punishment than immunity. And in a way, again, we shouldn't really be too hard on them for that. We wouldn't want them there to be just, you know, salivating at the prospect. You wouldn't want a medical profession to say, yeah, just bring it on, no problem. You'd want them to be very cautious and to think very deeply. And ultimately, for people of conscience to say they don't believe in it, it's very important we respect that and hear their cautionary notes. But at the end of the day, the parliaments need to be able to enact the will of the people.
Let's talk a little more about the lead up to death and the way in which doctors are being taught how to deal with that lead up. You teach at University of Tasmania.
Yes.
Are our medical students and young doctors being taught what they need to be taught in order to be more facilitative of those last weeks of life?
Look, yes and no. I have no doubt that in all our universities and medical schools in Australia and New Zealand and in Britain and Canada, comparable countries, I think there's been an enormous amount of effort to introduce good palliative care teaching, and there is a lot of good stuff out there. But it's really all taking place against a backdrop of very strong forces that kind of revert back to the notion of medicine as the defeater of death. You know, the medical success is measured by keeping death at bay, and a sense that there is an ethical imperative to keep people alive no matter what. And obviously the first function of medicine is to heal the sick, to prevent death wherever it's a possible and reasonable thing to do, absolutely. But being able to acknowledge the limitations of medicine is always going to be important, no matter what stage of technical progress we do or do not reach in the foreseeable future. So I think our students need to be empowered to, excuse me, to be able to acknowledge those and to live by those ethical precepts of putting life first and of prolonging life wherever possible, but not to prolong the dying process. Yeah. And I say to students that if you've elected to come to medical school, if you've studied and worked hard to get into this professional training, you've also made either a conscious or an unconscious decision to come and work in the middle of death, dying, loss and grief, because those things will be happening around you in almost all areas of medicine in some form or another during your working life.
Yep.
And that it's important to develop the attitude, knowledge and skills to deal with those things well. And that includes acknowledging the limitations of medicine and helping people to understand what can and cannot be done for them in a particular situation, and then being able to communicate that effectively, support people through the decision-making process, and where appropriate, to support family and friends.
Are we getting better at it?
It would depend on what day you ask me. Overall, I think the issue is out there, but I think we still lack the kind of direct acknowledgement of reality.
Yeah.
We still struggle with that. We still tend to pull the punches. For instance, if you go to your local paper and look up the death columns, the one thing that's interesting is that nobody dies anymore. Everybody passes away.
Yes.
Now, I don't know what it is about that term or what it is about me that finds that actually quite irritating, because I've got the sense that somebody somewhere is trying to sort of cushion the blow a little bit with language, which is supremely unhelpful. These people have died. Why can't we say that? Why do we have to invent a new word that suggests they've kind of just slipped behind a curtain? Or it's quite interesting.
The media have become quite overly sensitive as well about this stuff. I mean, we're constantly given guidelines about reporting suicides, for example. Yeah. Is there a point in a person's hospital admission where these conversations have to start happening? And are we doing it early enough? And are we involving enough of the family? Or are we still, you know, putting it all off until it's beyond the point of futile?
Yeah, definitely that would be the case. That, you know, as you'll be aware, we've now got well-developed tools nationally and in most jurisdictions in Australia to do advanced care planning, so-called mm-hmm. advanced directives. And I think everybody who works in the area and is trying to develop this will agree that there's a lot of buy-in. There's a lot of investment of hope, you know, that this is the answer.
Yeah.
But on the ground, there is still quite substantial resistance to somehow perhaps raise mortality too early. You know, don't mention death, it'll kill him sort of thing. It'll bring things on.
Yes.
And I think that's where one would hope that things would change, because with those journeys I was talking about earlier, the 1 to 2 years at the end of life, once you're getting into that last 1 to 2 years, in other words, substantially before actual death, it's really important to start to talk not about if I die, but when I die.
Yeah.
And to make it clear to those around you what your values are, what your beliefs are. Our advanced directive here in Tasmania is very focused on death, which is quite controversial, because some people, I think, feel it's too in your face. But really what the main panel of it says is, if the doctors looking after me think I'm dying, it's okay to let me die. In other words, you don't have to carry out heroics.
Yeah.
If you honestly think there's no chance of me returning to a quality of life that I've articulated in the directive. So some people say, you know, if I can't recognise those around me, if I can't toilet myself, if I can't move,
yeah,
you know, those sorts of quality parameters, then I would not want you to prolong that. This is very important in dementia, which is now projected to affect anything up to a third of the population. To be able to say, when you have full capacity, by all means, you know, treat me for comfort and dignity, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't want my life in a demented state to be prolonged. And therefore, I don't want my slow dying of dementia to be prolonged.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's going to be very important. And at the moment, it doesn't happen nearly enough, because people don't recognise dementia as a fatal illness process.
And yet it's showing up on a lot of death certificates, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Doctors have vastly increased the number of certifications now where they give dementia as the main cause or one of the leading causes of death.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Professor Ashby, for your time today. And this should be hopefully online to coincide with our pain issue, which is coming out on April the 7th. So thank you for your time.
Thanks very much, Kate. Bye-bye.
No worries.
That was Michael Ashby on death, palliative care and pain management. Join us next time as Kate Swanell interviews Rear Admiral Robin Walker, Surgeon General of the ADF.